Communication is everywhere. But what is it? Communication is how you share your thoughts, your opinions, your culture, from what you see on TV to what you post online. But what about the people who are not being seen or heard? AMI is a media company that strives to be a voice for Canadians with disabilities, whether it's through positive portrayal, reflection, and accessible media. AMI believes everyone should be included, and that includes you. AMI is inclusion. Experience AMI at amiplus.ca.
Hi, I'm Amy Goodman, host of Democracy Now! For more than 15 years, CJSF 90.1 FM has been bringing Democracy Now! To the greater Vancouver area every weekday at 11 a.m. From New York, this is Democracy Now! Human Rights Watch is accusing Israel of committing acts of extermination and genocide by intentionally depriving Palestinians in Gaza of water. We'll speak with the group's Israel-Palestine Associate Director. Then to Syria, where mass graves are being uncovered following the toppling of the Assad regime.
We established that these summary executions took place in the Tadalmon area of Damascus on April 16, 2013. Since the fall of the Assad government, we have been able to travel to Damascus to see the area for ourselves.
And in California, the federal government will pay a record $116 million to more than 100 women who were sexually abused in a federal prison in Dublin, California.
The reason we're seeing historic, unprecedented lawsuits winning against the federal prison system is because the issue of staff sexual abuse is rampant across not just the federal prison system, but every type of carceral facility across the country. And when survivors speak up and link up with advocates on the outside, we're seeing that historic wins are possible.
We'll speak to an organizer with the California Coalition for Women Prisoners and one of the former prisoners at Dublin who's a plaintiff in the case. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Fresh Israeli attacks on the Gaza Strip have killed at least 25 Palestinians, including children. That includes 16 people killed in Jabalia in northern Gaza, a strike on Maghazi refugee camp that killed four, and bombings in Gaza City that killed at least five others. Survivors scrambled to retrieve people from under the rubble.
At exactly 10:02 at night, we were sleeping. Suddenly, we heard the sounds of a strike. How, we don't know. We went down and found it was our neighbor's house, the Zaytunia family. We pulled out several martyrs, children and women, and until now, there are still people under the rubble they cannot reach. As you can see, they're pulling them out. They're digging with their hands.
Among the recent victims of Israel's bombardment of Gaza were twin sisters Sally and Dalia Ghazi Ibaid. The 26-year-olds had recently been accepted to attend the University of Waterloo in Ontario, Canada, as part of the Global Student Relief Initiative, which supports students from conflict zones. They were killed by an Israeli bombing on December 5th as they attempted to leave Gaza via the Rafah border crossing into Egypt. A new report in the Israeli newspaper Haaretz finds Israel's military's designated the Netzarim corridor, which cuts the Gaza Strip in half, as a kill zone. The report quotes Israeli soldiers describing how they arbitrarily killed dozens of Palestinian civilians, including children, then posthumously declared them to be terrorists. Separately, Human Rights Watch warns in a new report that since October 2023, Israeli authorities have deliberately obstructed Palestinians' access to the adequate amount of water required for survival in the Gaza Strip, an act tantamount to genocide. Meanwhile, Israel killed at least nine people in overnight bombing raids on port infrastructure and oil storage facilities near Yemen's capital Sana'a. The bombings came after Israel's military said it had intercepted a missile launched by Yemen's Houthis before it crossed into Israeli territory. The U.S. Senate has approved a record $895 billion military spending package on a bipartisan vote of 85-14, sending the bill to President Biden for his signature. Congress approved this year's National Defense Authorization Act, or NDAA, even after the Pentagon failed its seventh consecutive audit, with Pentagon officials unable to fully account for trillions of dollars. An amendment to the NDAA strips away service members' parental rights to access gender-affirming health care for transgender children. That prompted calls from the ACLU and other civil rights groups for President Biden to veto the legislation. The bill also includes more than $500 million in additional military aid to Israel. Republican lawmakers have rejected House Speaker Mike Johnson's plan to avert a government shutdown after President-elect Trump condemned the deal and Elon Musk threatened to end the political careers of Republicans who support it. Unless Congress approves new spending by midnight Friday, most federal agencies will shut down non-essential operations. Johnson's compromise plan included more than $100 billion in disaster aid to states hard hit by hurricanes Helene and Milton and other natural disasters. It also included $30 billion in economic assistance to farmers. Politico reports the Republican House Speaker Johnson is now considering passing a so-called clean funding package that excludes farm relief and disaster aid. Johnson's reversal came after Elon Musk, the world's richest person, wrote on his social media site X, quote, "Any member of the House or Senate who votes for this outrageous spending bill deserves to be voted out in 2 years." Responding to Musk, Vermont Independent Senator Bernie Sanders wrote, quote, "Billionaires must not be allowed to run our government." House Republicans have introduced the DOGE Act, a bill to cut federal spending by $114 billion. The bill would slash programs for climate, education, energy, healthcare, transportation, veterans care, and more. However, it would not reduce Pentagon spending. On Tuesday, Republicans convened the first meeting of the Delivering Outstanding Government Efficiency Caucus, or DOGE. The new caucus's name is a nod to the Department of Government Efficiency, an advisory commission led by the unelected billionaires Elon Musk and Vivek Ramaswamy. It's also a reference to a meme coin cryptocurrency promoted by Musk. At least one Republican lawmaker, Greg Lopez of Colorado, said at the DOGE caucus meeting he expects cuts to Social Security and Medicare despite Trump's campaign pledge to leave the programs alone.
Sir, can we get a pledge to stand with President Trump against cuts to Social Security and Medicare benefits?
I think, you know what, when we look to reduce our national debt, I think these should be on the table.
Okay.
You know, so I am a strong advocate of discussing this and reevaluating them. And I do believe at the end of the day, there will be some cuts.
There are cuts to Social Security and Medicare?
Yes.
The House Ethics Committee has reportedly voted to release its report on former Congressmember Matt Gaetz, including his sex trafficking of underage girls. The report could be made public as soon as this week after lawmakers cast their final votes of the 118th Congress. The firestorm around the report and the accusations led to Gaetz withdrawing from consideration to be attorney general under the incoming Trump administration. Meanwhile, Trump has tapped failed U.S. Senate candidate Herschel Walker to become ambassador to the Bahamas. Walker, who lost his 2022 Georgia Senate race to Raphael Warnock, has been accused of violence by his ex-wife, as well as pressuring at least two partners to have abortions, even though his public stance is ardently anti-abortion. In a case that's galvanized France, a court has found the ex-husband of a French woman, Gisèle Pelicot, guilty on all charges for repeatedly raping his wife and inviting dozens of other men to rape her after he drugged her unconscious. A panel of judges sentenced Dominique Pelicot to the maximum 20 years in prison, 50 other men who also raped or sexually assaulted Gisele Pellicot with her husband's help were also found guilty. The shocking case has made headlines around the world, and the 3.5-month trial gripped France, with supporters regularly gathering around the Avignon courthouse to support Gisele Pellicot, who famously waived anonymity to give a voice to survivors and change the public discourse on sexual violence. She told the court during the trial, quote, "It's not for us to feel shame, it's for them." She also insisted videos of her rapes be shown in court as part of the trial. Gisele Pellicot spoke after the verdict was pronounced.
Je pense enfin aux victimes non reconnues.
I'm thinking about the victims who aren't recognized and whose stories often remain in the shadows. I want you to know we share the same struggle. I wish to express my deepest gratitude to all those who've supported me throughout this ordeal. Your testimonies devastated me, and I was able to pull the strength from them to come back every day to face these long days of the trial.
Gisele Pellicot is 72 years old. The charges of rape and the acts engaged in by the men go back over the last decade. The U.S. government will pay a record nearly $116 million to settle lawsuits brought by 103 women who survived sexual abuse and assault at the now-shuttered Federal Correctional Institution in Dublin, California. The prison became known as the Rape Club due to the systematic assaults perpetrated by staff on prisoners. We'll have more on the story later in the broadcast and hear from one of the survivors and plaintiffs in the case. In Texas, a Houston father is fighting to reunite his family after Immigration and Customs Enforcement, or ICE, deported his wife and four children to Mexico last week. Two of the children, infant twins, are U.S. citizens born in September. The father, Federico Arellano Jr., is also a U.S. citizen. The mother, Christina Salazar, and the couple's four children were apparently lured by ICE to a meeting point where they were arrested and forced into a plane to Reynosa, Mexico. They were targeted for deportation after Salazar and their older children missed an immigration hearing because she was recovering from her emergency cesarean section, which the family had notified the court of. This comes as President-elect Trump has repeatedly vowed to end birthright citizenship. Another employee of President Biden's State Department has resigned over U.S. policy towards Gaza. Mike Casey quietly left his role as deputy political counselor on Gaza, one of only two jobs specifically focused on Gaza, in July, after realizing all his reports were systematically dismissed despite the rapidly mounting death toll and catastrophic humanitarian situation in Gaza. Casey found that, unlike in his previous diplomatic work in Malaysia, China, and Pakistan, the U.S. government does not expect Israeli authorities to listen to any of their recommendations or demands and instead defers completely to Israel. Mike Casey told The Guardian in an interview about his resignation, he, quote, got so tired of writing about dead kids and that, quote, we don't have a policy on Palestine. We just do what the Israelis want us to do, he said. The U.S. Supreme Court has agreed to rule on the constitutionality of a contested TikTok ban. Under the law passed by a bipartisan Congress, the highly popular social media platform would become banned unless its Chinese owner, ByteDance, sells the app to an American company by January 19th. Critics have described the ban as a form of censorship fueled by anti-Chinese sentiment. The state of Indiana has carried out its first execution in 15 years, killing 49-year-old Joseph Corcoran by lethal injection after a 27-year legal battle to spare his life. Corcoran had been convicted of killing his brother and three other men, including his sister's fiancé, in 1997. Corcoran's lawyers say his execution was unconstitutional since he suffered from paranoid schizophrenia. Corcoran's sister fought for the execution to be halted, saying she had forgiven him and that, quote, I believe that the death penalty does not address grief or provide true justice, especially for victims and those with mental illness. Instead, it's a lengthy, costly, and political process, she said. And thousands of Amazon workers have launched the largest strike against the retail giant in U.S. history, setting up picket lines at hundreds of Amazon fulfillment centers nationwide. Workers say Amazon forced them to strike by refusing to follow the law and bargain with the thousands of Amazon workers who organized with the Teamsters Union. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman.
And I'm Nermeen Sheikh. Welcome to our listeners and viewers across the country and around the world. We turn now to a grim reality that Syrians are facing after the toppling of the Assad regime, the discovery of mass graves across the country. According to the International Commission on Missing Persons, more than 150,000 Syrians remain unaccounted for after being held in Assad's prisons. Many are believed to be buried in mass graves. The Syrian search and rescue group, White Helmets, has received reports of at least 13 mass grave sites across the country, eight of them near Damascus. Human Rights Watch visited the site of one mass grave, also a mass execution site, in the Tadumun neighborhood of Damascus last week. The group was able to confirm the exact location of the grave after verifying and geolocating a previously leaked video from April 2013.
The video shows Syrian government forces and pro-government militia shooting 11 men in civilian clothing, blindfolded and bound. The victims' bodies then fall into a pit. One of three perpetrators films while the other two men carry out the executions, taunting and laughing at victims as they die. Human Rights Watch was unable to travel to Syria when we were first made aware of this video, so we went through an extensive process to verify it. We gathered witness evidence, and by matching landmarks in the footage with satellite imagery, we identified the exact location of the mass grave. We established that these summary executions took place in the Tadamun area of Damascus on April 16, 2013. Since the fall of the Assad government, we have been able to travel to Damascus to see the area for ourselves. We know the grave was a machine-dug pit between two buildings. It measured approximately 3 meters wide, 7 meters long, and 2 meters deep. In the footage, 13 bodies are visible in the pit. During the course of the 6-minute, 43-second video, the gunmen kill 11 more. In visiting the grave here, we also discovered today the presence of human remains in and around the site. These victims deserve a decent burial. Their families deserve to know what happened to them. Today, the pit is filled in. Local residents told us that access to the square kilometers surrounding this mass grave was restricted by Syrian authorities for a long time. One resident told us that pro-government forces ordered him to bury bodies some years after the executions. It's unclear to what extent human remains in the area have been removed since 2013. All this is evidence of just one of many atrocities carried out by the Assad government. In this case, Human Rights Watch has identified the man in the blue-gray uniform as Najib Halabi, who died later in the conflict. The other man, initially identified by the University of Amsterdam researchers who first sent us the video, worked for Syrian military intelligence as recently as March 2023. Any surviving perpetrators of this or other atrocities should be held accountable as part of a fair judicial process. The 2013 massacre, documented on video, is just one of many summary killings in the area.
We're joined now from Amman, Jordan, by Hiba Zayadeen, senior Middle East and North Africa researcher at Human Rights Watch. She just returned from a week in Damascus. Hiba, welcome to Democracy Now! If you could just begin by talking about what you learned from your time in Damascus and what you saw.
Absolutely, and thank you for having me on the show. So upon arriving in Damascus, one of the first sites that we decided to visit was that of the heinous 2013 Tadamun massacre, which a video of had leaked in 2021. We had been investigating this crime for a long time now. We had confirmed the exact location of the mass grave and decided to go confirm it for ourselves. But what we found there, you know, we were not prepared for what we had found. We were not prepared for what we were going to see, even though we knew from conversations with residents earlier in 2021 that it was the likely site of other summary killings as well. But when we arrived, what we saw was scores of human remains, of fingers, of a part of a skull, pelvic bones strewn across the surrounding neighborhood. We saw families, families had brought to us bags that they had collected of bones from the rubble in dilapidated stores in the area. We saw children toying with these bones. It was not anything that we had expected, to see. And we spoke to more residents and found out, you know, that this was the site of so much more horror than we had expected. I had spoken to a resident who was forced at age of 15, this was back in 2016, to dig graves and to dump bodies, corpses, into those graves. We had found, we had spoken to an ambulance driver who was tasked to retrieve bodies from that area in 2018 and 2019. I spoke to countless families who had missing loved ones that they did not know what had happened to and had no answers for. And so, you know, it was really important that we highlight how imperative it is to protect and to secure this site and many others like it. There are mass graves across Syria, and this was just one of them. And we had visited others as well. We had seen desperate families, visiting these sites, sometimes taking matters into their own hands, digging the graves on their own, trying to find anything about this. We saw them at the morgue where there were several unidentified bodies, families, you know, clutching pictures of their loved ones, pushing it into the camera to try and show it to the world, to try and get any sort of information. We also visited, you know, some of the most notorious detention facilities that we had for a long time worked on and documented abuses and torture in. You know, what we found there too was quite upsetting, in that there was intentional destruction of documents, of evidence. There was looting. There was total insecurity for the first couple of days that we were there, with people coming in, retrieving files, leaving with them, tampering with the evidence. And we know, you know, that the Assad government operated a chilling bureaucratic system whereby they documented every crime. They documented it in detail. And that evidence had existed in these detention facilities, in the military courts, in the prisons themselves. And every minute that passes where there is inaction, where these documents, these sites are not being preserved and not being secured, is just one more family possibly never knowing what happened to their loved ones. And it also means that there are officials who had perpetrated some of the most horrific atrocities over the past decade that will go free and that will not be brought to justice because of just how quickly a lot of this evidence is disappearing.
Well, I'd like to read from a Financial Times article headlined "The Syrian Neighborhood at the Heart of Assad's Killing Machine," which is the neighborhood that you've just spoken about, Tadamun. The article begins saying, quote, "In Tadamun, the children know the difference between a human jaw and a dog's. So inured are they to decomposing remains, a consequence of living in the desolate Damascus suburb, that the boys casually toss around skulls and fractured femurs." So, Hiba, if you could speak, you just talked about the importance of protecting these sites. I mean, many have said that Assad's regime has just fallen and this work is only just beginning, the work of excavating these mass graves. Are there concerns that these sites will not be protected? And if not, where will the who will damage them? How will they somehow be disrupted?
Definitely, there are concerns right now. I mean, we have seen that for transitional authorities, this has not been a top priority. And our presence in Damascus was to call for the preservation of this evidence, was to make it clear to transitional authorities that this must be a priority and that it is of the utmost urgency, because now is the time. Yesterday was the time. A week ago was the time to be protecting these sites. And as I had said earlier, every day that passes, we're losing more valuable information. And, you know, it is a priority, or it should be a priority to transitional authorities, not just because of justice and accountability efforts, but also because you have thousands upon thousands of families who are seeking answers, who deserve answers, and who have no idea what the transitional authorities are doing about this right now. They need to be raising awareness about what it means to tamper with this evidence, what it means to retrieve documents from an area without, you know, preserving the chain of custody. Because, you know, once you take these documents out without documenting exactly who and how and from where they were taken, none of this is going to stand in court. And this is what we've been impressing upon transitional authorities. This is what we've been calling for UN bodies, relevant bodies, to arrive at the scene as soon and as urgently as possible. We've been calling on international rescue teams to also arrive on site, and for Syrian groups to really be at the forefront of this massive, massive effort.
This is State Department spokesperson Matthew Miller speaking earlier this week.
When you look at the evidence that is coming out of Syria in the now 10 days since the Assad regime fell, it continues to shock the conscience. And I'm referring not just to the mass graves that have been uncovered, but information that we have been gathering inside the United States government, including information that's not yet publicly known.
Can you respond, Heba, to these remarks, in particular, Matt Miller suggesting more will be revealed about abuses by the Assad regime?
So, I mean, absolutely more will be revealed. And I think, you know, there have been documents in detention facilities that remain intact. And there is movement. You know, we have seen a bit more of a stepping up in the security of some of these detention facilities. But there is no coordinated effort right now to preserve these documents. And it is really important to stress that these documents belong to the Syrian people. This evidence belongs to the Syrian people, and they need to be at the forefront of these efforts to preserve and secure, obviously with the help of UN relevant bodies, obviously with the help of international actors. But these documents belong to the Syrian people. The evidence belongs to them and needs to remain with them and in their hands. And that's what I would stress in response to some of these remarks.
Heba, what is Human Rights Watch looking out for when Israel intensifies the attacks on Syria, expanding its occupation of the Golan Heights? You've said that Israel bombed the only facility in Syria that had DNA equipment that would allow for the identification of remains in these mass graves. Can you explain?
Yes. So, I mean, Israel's strikes in Syria come on the heels of its brutal military campaigns in Lebanon and in Gaza, where we've documented war crimes, crimes against humanity, and as we were, you know, my colleague has just been saying on your show, acts of genocide in Gaza specifically. You know, Syria is right now in a very fragile state, and the Israeli strikes have almost completely decimated its defense capabilities, but also this has had repercussions and consequences for the issue that we're speaking of right now, the preservation of evidence. Some of these strikes have hit vital facilities, including, you know, the Air Force Intelligence Branch, you know, the institute where these DNA machines were being housed. Other security branches, military security branches that contain vital evidence. And so these strikes are also adding to the quite, you know, upsetting situation that we currently find ourselves in terms of just preserving evidence, making sure that someday, you know, hopefully every family can learn what, you know, what the fate of their loved ones had been and where they may have been buried, and to really be able to give them a decent burial.
Heba Zayadeen, I want to thank you so much for being with us. Senior Middle East and North Africa researcher at Human Rights Watch. She's just returned from Syria.
Observing my environment to see contradictions in concrete conditions. Evidence we're living in an obsolete system. Poverty stricken folks constantly living hope. American dreams dangling from a rope by God, folks. Working in the public school sector. Who lose one youth to death per semester? I guess the cost of living is going up.